What's up, everybody? Welcome back to I Came With Fire podcast. You guys just missed a good conversation on Zach's upbringing and his music interests before
or
we
lack
hopped
thereof.
In. Lack thereof, yeah. So, but we're here with Derek Josie. The conversation started on music because of the Blink-182 song Josie. And Zach has no idea what it is, but Derek did, which is pretty freaking cool of him. So, but Derek, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself for everybody, and we'll jump right in.
Absolutely. My name is Derek Josie. I am a dairy farmer in Tillamook, Oregon, and I have a slight social media presence where I show my daily life as a dairy farmer and dispel the lies and propaganda put out by those dummies that don't want us to eat meat or drink dairy.
Dummies. Awesome. It is dumb. I don't understand it, man. And there's some crazy stuff in your book, which I have right here for everybody, an industry worth fighting for. So you should definitely check it out. It's actually not that long of a read, but it's really, really good. There's a lot of good information, some crazy stuff in there. One of these things I want to bring up, I think, is actually wild and pretty dangerous that somebody would do that. But we'll get to that part. But anyway, yeah. So I recently read a statistic that American dairy farming is a $45 billion a year industry. And that's larger than a lot of GDPs for some countries around the world. So you guys have an incredible impact on the American economy. So it's pretty scary to think that there's a group of people out there attacking you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the industry as a whole is really huge. And it's not only just in this country. We also are a major exporter of dairy products to the world. One out of every 7 days worth of production in the United States actually goes to trading partners. A lot of it goes into Mexico because they love their dairy products down there.
You need queso
for sure.
Yeah,
dude, and I love queso. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, one of the biggest things is I mean, I know a little bit about a dairy farm, not a lot. I used to work on my grandfather's dairy farm in upstate New York. So I've had the pleasure of shoveling shit into a gutter and doing all that. So getting up early with him. But it's not all glamour, right? Yes. One of the reasons I want to have you on is because I know that like farming in general, not just dairy farming, is definitely under attack in our country. So one of the biggest things I was hoping you kind of fill us in on is how state governments get involved in farming as far as like regulation go, and then the federal government. Because I know it has a lot to do with the way you guys get paid and prices of milk and all of that. It's pretty intense.
Yeah, absolutely. Like milk price, I don't think anybody actually understands how the milk prices are set. I like to joke that there's just a room with some monkeys and a spinning board and they throw darts because it doesn't seem like there's
sounds
a
like
lot
the US
of
government.
Yeah, it sounds it really sounds plausible. So
yeah,
it's true. But yeah, the federal government sets the price, kind of. I mean, it is market driven. And then from there, you have regional prices, and it's very intricate and hard to explain how we get paid. But we are paid. Ironically, we produce a fluid product, right? But we are paid in pounds. So we get paid in pounds of milk.
Right. Okay. That's like talking about jet fuel. It's talked about in pounds. Interesting. When did like dairy farming as an industry take the biggest hit, like the past maybe couple decades? What really sort of changed the landscape?
So, I mean, there's been a lot of times that it, obviously the 80s when we went through the interest rate crisis and the economy went in the toilet, that had a devastating impact on all of agriculture, really. Because a lot of agriculture we run on, even dairy farming, you put seed in the ground. A lot of us carry a operating line of credit, so you borrow the money to put everything in the ground, grow it, and harvest it, and hope that you get enough product and harvest to actually pay off that operating line and have some profit at the end of the year.
A lot of risk
involved. And so, you know, in the 80s, when interest rates skyrocketed, it made it really hard to try and run a business. But more recently, when when the big C happened with COVID, and they shut everything down. I think it's 35%. I shouldn't be that exact. Somewhere between 30% and 40% of all dairy products would go into the food services side.
Yeah.
And go back to government regulations. So, silly things like, you know, food services, they'd be buying a 2-pound bag of shredded cheese, but you couldn't divert that bag of cheese to a retail because it didn't have all the correct labeling on it. Mm-hmm. And so you had 30 to 40% of all dairy products just grind to a halt, which, you know, when the manufacturers aren't able to move product, they can't bring in fresh milk. So then you had farmers that were ending up having to just put milk down the drain because you can't tell the cow to stop producing milk.
Right.
So that was a disaster. It was not fun. Surprisingly, though, the industry as a whole learned how to be really nimble and quickly learned how to get product out of the food service side and get it into retailers where people could actually get the product. And so it might have made our whole industry a little more robust in the future.
That kind of seemed to be one of the outcomes of the Big C, like you said. In general, people had to get crafty and creative with how their products got shipped internationally, you know, whatever. But how did, and quickly, right? Yeah, especially with a product like milk, right? How did you guys sort of navigate that, like you said, and figure out a different way to market and sell your product?
Well, so I'm actually a member of the Tillamook Co-op. So anybody that buys Tillamook dairy products, that could have came from my farm, and I've got a.
I do.
They're amazing.
Yep.
I'm not biased at all. Oh, you see, great. We just came out with the little pints of our ice cream. So that's a single serving. It's, you know.
Yeah. Awesome.
But anyway, our crew,
the original size was a single serving for me.
Well, yes. Back when I was younger, it definitely was.
Sure.
But our crew down at the factory, you know, our behind the scenes, they just moved mountains, and we were one of the lucky ones that we were a retail brand. And so we had the capacity to turn up production, and we were probably one of the better ones at supplying the retailers when they, all of a sudden, they had 30 to 40% more demand. And so we did really well during COVID because we were able to fulfill. And so we came out smelling like roses during that, luckily. So, we had as a co-op been thinking about getting into the food services side because it's a huge market. And luckily we were just barely dipping our toes in at that point.
Got you. So you're talking about your co-op, and you talk about the TCCA and in your book. Can you kind of give the listeners a little background on that and what that means to be a part of it?
Absolutely. So I'm going to get the dates wrong, but I think it was 1912. All the farmers in Tillamook County, there was something like 10 different creameries in this county, and they all came together and formed the Tillamook County Creamery Association. And we became a farmers co-op, which means the farmers own the manufacturing and did the marketing of their own cheese. And over time, I mean, just like every business, we've expanded. There's still, I think, 58 of us are farmers that are still, we still own the Tillamook Co-op. We own the brand. So it is truly a farmer owned. We've brought in a lot of outside experienced people to help run the business, obviously. But it's still directed and ran by farmers.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And my great grandpa was actually, we came into Tillamook in about the 1912, and he helped, before we became dairy farmers, he helped bring them all together. And in 1918, he decided to start the original dairy that my family started on.
Wow. So yeah, you guys are like deep rooted. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to actually say, because like I was talking a little bit with Brandon before you came on. Usually most dairy farms, they tend to just go down generation to generation. Like they just get passed on and it just keeps going. But here in New York, so I'm in upstate New York in like the Utica, Rome area. When I was a recruiter, I recruited a like an 18-year-old kid into the Air Force because his parents didn't want him to inherit their dairy farm because they were like in so much debt and they were struggling with like a bunch of government overreach and a whole bunch of other stuff to where if you're not part of their specific chain, then your stuff doesn't get sold on a national level and a whole bunch of other things. And so they're actually going to close their farm down here because they're like selling off their stuff and getting rid of it. So like their several hundred year family farm is going to just be gone because they decided, no, we don't want our son to live our lives. It's been very hard. Is that something you've thought about? Do you deal with that? I mean, I know you're part of the Tillamook group, but what's it like dealing sometimes with the government who might impose some pretty drastic restrictions on you or say, hey, I know it cost you, I don't know the exact numbers, but hey, I know it cost you $10 to get this gallon, but you're going to only charge, you're only going to make $2 off it. I don't know if that's a thing, but like, what's that like?
It definitely can be a thing. But going back to the fact that I'm part of Tillamook, I'm one of the lucky ones where we have a branded product and we set our own milk price. We don't actually, we kind of do our best to ignore what the federal government says we're supposed to be getting paid. So I'm not saying we're making a ton of money, but at least this way, because the milk price for normal dairy farmers changes every month. So
yeah,
for example, some months, well, let's say it's a high of $24 a hundredweight. If you're milking 500 cows and then you're going to be making a nice paycheck, well, the next month it can drop down to $16 a hundredweight. And that would literally be like your paycheck losing a third in 1 month. And it makes it really, your feed bills don't do that. Your electrical bill doesn't do that. So it really... Yeah. Being part of Tillamook and having, we set our price at a year at a time so that we can actually have a budget. But why does go ahead.
I was going to say, why does the price of like something for per 100 whey, why does it change so frequently?
Is it supply and demand? They do go, it's supposed to be on that. Yes. They look at, you know, forward contracting, because it is something that is bought and sold on the commodities market. And then the federal government at the end of the month decides what the final price will be. So you can, you know, hedge and do all that stuff. It's a weird system.
Because I was going to say like oil, you know, oil and gas, that gets bought and used just as much as I would assume milk and dairy does, but like the federal government does better at maintaining that, like keeping it relatively on a straight line, either going slightly up or slightly down. It's very rare because like you could walk into a grocery store and it feels like 1 week your gallon of milk could be like $2.40, and then the next week it could be $5. You're like, what the heck?
Yeah.
But I in my entire life, I'm 31, but I've never had a time where I went to the pump 1 week and it was, you know, $2.80, and then the next week it was $4.50. Like it doesn't jump that much, you know. It just seems weird.
Part of that also is fuel isn't a perishable product, whereas dairy is.
Okay.
So
get up.
But going back to your question about government overreach, I'm in Oregon, so I know all about
for sure.
Government overreach.
Yeah.
They 2 years ago, they just passed a new amendment or law regarding CAFOs, which are confined animal feed operations. And in Oregon, all dairies and most beef operations, if you're feeding inside, you are one of those. And so they added more restrictions. They did a whole bunch of stuff. It was the environmental groups that really pushed it. And they got some help from some small acreage farms that were trying to keep large operations out of Oregon. Mm-hmm. But ironically, it turns out that in the bill, there was regulations that they were going to start regulating the small acreage farmers under the same regulations.
It sort of hurt and them.
Pulled a sneaky on
more
them.
Than it hurt the yeah. large farmers.
Oh, well, yeah, because I'm all, so I'm technically a large CAFO. So we've had to deal with these regulations for decades at this point. We have the manure systems, we have all the containment to, and all the, we document everything. We know what we're doing. A lot of these small acreage people, you know, they were being told, well, you're going to have to contain that wastewater that you're washing your milking equipment for your two cows. You can't just let it drain out onto your road. And mm-hmm. it's just like, okay, that little bit of water, and it was going to cost them, you know, $10,000, $20,000 to put containment for two cows. And it's just like that.
It's insane.
Insane. It's insane.
It really seems like the goal ultimately is to just eradicate smaller farms, and then these attacks kind of leap up to bigger organizations, right? Like mm-hmm. Tillamook and larger co-ops around the country to eventually just be a totally government regulated farming. And that's something that you mentioned in the book, collective farming, and you gave a pretty good synopsis. You talked about like Czechoslovakia and Ukraine, but you're going to do a much better job at summarizing that than I am. But I was wondering if you could kind of explain why an entirely federally owned farming system in the country is a bad idea.
Well, I can. So I'm just going to do with Oregon. So in Oregon, right. you have the Perfect. Coastal areas, right? Where we're very wet. We're mm-hmm. pretty temperate. We don't get too hot. We don't get too cold. Then you have the Willamette Valley area, which is the next area in. They get a third of the rain we do. They get hot. Their weather's almost perfect. They get enough rain that they can grow a lot of crops. And then you have on the east side of Oregon, it's high mm-hmm. desert. Barely any rain. Well, they make laws. They're all the same laws for the whole state. And laws that are designed for my area make no mm-hmm. sense for somebody on the east side. Mm-hmm. And so if you expand that out, every time the federal government gets involved, you know, they don't have the every time you make laws that are being made by people further away, mm-hmm. they're not going to do what they're intended to do.
Mm-hmm.
It makes no sense. And it fails every time.
Yeah. Well, what sort of representation do you guys have there in DC, or what has happened like delegation wise to try to enlighten some of these people to get them to understand what you guys go through?
Right. So yeah, we have our lobbying firms, just like every industry. I mean, we have mm-hmm. Dairy Association. We have the federal organizations for our factories, and I'm part of the Small Business Association, because farms are small business. And that's one of the things, that the more regulations that happen, the more people are realizing, okay, yeah, maybe we do need to unite. Just because you have a store and I'm a dairy farmer doesn't mean we don't have a lot of the same concerns. And mm-hmm. it's better that we start working together than stay separated. And they've gotten really good at trying to designate us into our own little boxes and mm-hmm. not have us talking to each other. And the more we can do that and utilize other industries to make our voices larger, the more impact we're going to have.
Yeah. I would imagine this, something as large as Tillamook probably has a big voice, or am I...
As large as you think we think Tillamook is, I mean, we did just hit $1 billion as a company this last year. Okay. We are, I think we're the 50 something, number 50 on co-op size for,
wow.
So we're not really that, we're a drop in the bucket. We're not.
I would have never guessed that.
Yeah. Well, most co-ops don't have a large branded presence like we do.
Okay.
Most of the co-ops are supplying other businesses with the milk, and they're putting their brand on them. So
yeah,
we do have an outsized presence in the grocery store as a co-op, but as a member of our industry, we are just one of many.
Got you. Zach, you've been trying to ask a question.
Yeah, well, I had to relook it up because I watched and read stuff about like the government and their involvement in like the dairy industry and like how it's like been good/bad at certain times. And it was back in like the 60s where the government invested a ton of money into the dairy industry because they needed the US needed a lot of milk and stuff. And that's where like a whole lot of like the Got Milk ads like started sprouting up and a whole bunch and real big push for dairy stuff. But then they overinvested. So then there was too much milk and then it was hurting the industry in the 70s. So then there was like a dairy shortage or something. Like pendulum switched, right? And you can correct me on this because it was like they invested too much into it. So then there was too much milk. So then it was messing up all the sales of the dairy farmers and stuff. So they had the government pretty much had to just start buying all your dairy products to make it so that the dairy industry didn't go out of business. Am I getting that right? I might have the times wrong, but
I think you have it's. I'm not even sure what the dates are, but I want to touch on the Got Milk ads. Those were actually paid for by dairy farmers. But we'll go back to our checkoff after this. So yeah, in the 60s, 70s, and probably into the 80s, it wasn't just dairy. I mean, there was a lot of, you might as well just call them government welfare programs for farmers. Because the government felt like it was better that we not have everybody go out of business and starve. And so, you know, if prices got too low, they would go out and buy a bunch of government cheese.
Yeah.
That's where the reference to, you know, government cheese comes from. That's what I was getting
at, is there's the,
they would.
Yeah. There's a cheese cave
still, or I think they have.
Yeah. There's a cheese cave in Missouri that has 1.4 billion pounds of cheese. And some of that cheese has been like aging since the 70s. And like, it's like,
I'd really like to try some of that cheese. Actually,
I bet it tastes great. I was just thinking that,
but I guess the federal government, like every year, like it's like quarterly, they'll sit there and they'll be like, well, how's the cheese doing in like nationally? And if cheese is like getting too expensive or there's not enough in supply, they'll open the floodgates to the Missouri cheese caves. They'll like get rid of some of their cheese.
Well, yeah, I think they have to. Thankfully, they're not just dumping it all because they don't have those programs anymore. We still have government programs that are they're more of an insurance program. Like you can buy insurance that's if the milk price hits this point, it kicks in and it makes sure that your pay price stays there and doesn't keep going down.
So they like offset the difference in a way.
They actually offset the insurance premium. Okay. They help. It depends on the commodity, but they'll help. I think something up to like 50% depending on what coverage you go with.
Okay.
And that's it's much better than them just going out and buying a bunch of dairy products because it does the same thing. It makes it so you don't have the price hit the go through the floor and then everybody goes out of business. And then all of a sudden we don't have any dairy products anymore. It sets a floor, but it also makes it so you don't have the elasticity of price just going through the roof after that. So then it, as an industry, it's a little bit saner.
Hmm. So where does the government try to insert itself the most in the hopes of like trying to take over a little bit?
Which part of the government? So
that's a good question.
We have the EPA that would really, which would love for waters of the United States to get pushed through, and they continue to try and get that. And right now, the EPA has jurisdiction on major waterways that have, you know, barges and traffic and things like that, but they don't get to regulate the smaller rivers like the one I'm bordering, because there's no maritime commerce going on it. So okay. That's actually regulated through the state. And they do, our rivers are amazing. They do great. They do, as far as government goes, they do a fairly good job of making sure people aren't polluting the rivers around here. But the federal government would love to take that over and have control over everything. And they've done things like, in the Midwest, there'll be spots where, you know, during heavy rain events, there's drainage ditches that have water flowing, and the EPA comes in and wants to have control over that, even though 6 months out of the year, there's not even water in there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
it's not one a real area. Waterway.
Yeah, it's not, according to the government, it is. So that's Shocker. One way they do it. And then going back to the dairy, so you mentioned the Got Milk ads.
Yeah.
So the government, for all the commodities, came up with this idea that as commodity industries, there should be basically, I'm going to butcher how this works, but all dairy farmers pay a certain, I think it's like 17 cents per hundredweight into the dairy checkoff program, which is government regulated dairy advertising.
Yeah.
So these, we have them at the state level and the national level, we have one, and they have to promote the dairy industry. So that's where your Got Milk ads came from. And a lot of blanket dairy advertising you'll see.
Happy cows come from California or something like that. Yeah.
that would be the California checkoff. Yeah, yeah. Yes. But they have to be fact-based, and you can't disparage any other commodities. That's why you'll never see a blanket dairy product advertisement where they're like, you shouldn't drink nut juice because dairy is way better.
Right.
I can say that, but as an industry, we can't.
Yeah. Right. You're not going to have like a Chick-fil-A type ad, which is a cow and a sign.
Eat more chicken.
You know, drink more milk. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Fuck almonds, you know, something like that.
Yeah. Can't do it.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
And every commodity, you know, whether it's corn or soybeans, all of the major ones have these organizations, and they are quasi-government agencies because they have to get approval through the government to do the advertising. They have to
make sure they're fair and equitable and a whole bunch of other stupid stuff.
Yeah. All that.
Yeah. I don't know how much you have been able to check out any of our episodes, but Zach and I aren't very pro big government, right?
Me either.
Yeah, for good reason. And so I asked you about like where it tries to insert itself with you guys, because obviously the more a government inserts itself in any process, the less freedom you have as a citizen to do what you want, or like you as a dairy farmer, right? Mm-hmm. So you mentioned like the EPA, but like as far as like climate change, right? This is a big agenda. Where has the government tried to insert itself into the dairy farming industry in the name of climate change in a negative way?
Ironically, I almost think it's more industry pushed right now. Like the big corporations that buy agricultural products are asking us what we're doing to, you know, lower our carbon footprint. I mean, dairy came out with the net zero by 2040 or 2030, you know, just like everybody else.
Sure. Whatever platitude.
So, yeah. Greenwashing, but whatever. Mm-hmm. Oops. I'm going to be in trouble for that one.
You're good.
So yeah, it's definitely something that they're pushing. It is a ridiculous thing because, you're going to get me started. It just frustrates
trying
me
to get
no
you started,
end.
Derek. We're trying to get you started.
Tell all our listeners.
Carbon carbon credits in your book? You could talk about that. I thought that'd be pretty interesting too.
Yeah, well, the carbon credits are just a joke because anybody that has already done the things that they want us to do isn't, what is the word? Isn't allowed to gain any benefit from the carbon that they are already reducing because they've already done it. So that's already in. So it's just the people that haven't been doing, you know, a lot of these are no-brainer things like no tilling if you don't need to, because that keeps carbon in the soil. So any farmer that has half a brain is already doing most of the things that are good for the environment because, well, frankly, that's how we make our living.
Business. If, yeah.
Yeah. Literally. Yeah.
If we destroy our environment. Interest. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. Oh God. It's
what were you thinking of that was getting you worked up?
Oh, everything. The whole push, you know, in the United States, we have one of the most environmentally friendly, lowest carbon producing industries in agriculture in the world. We are some of the most efficient at our job in the world. And they continue to try and tell the rest of the world what we're going to do better. When we honestly could do more by helping the rest of the world implement things to get to our level. Because frankly, I don't want to have to feed the world. I just want to feed my community. So let the rest of the world feed themselves.
Do you think carbon credits... I was going to say, do you think carbon credits are kind of a counterproductive way to fix it? Because it, in a way, is like, hey, if you prove that you lower your carbon, we will give you like money or a kickback or something. When that in a way, like some farmers would be like, oh, okay, well then I'll just increase my carbon output and then lower it to get the kickback. Like, so I will ruin this to then lower it to save the planet. And then you will now pay me more. Thank you. Or give me whatever it is that kickback is.
Frankly, I think the whole carbon agenda is bullshit. True. It's just all of it. It's all a gimmick. Methane. So they come after cows for methane. Methane is produced when cows eat for forage and food, and it's digested, and the methane comes out in their burps. Do you know what happens if they don't eat that food and it just decomposes on the ground? The exact same amount of methane.
Yeah. Okay. The exact same.
So
there's difference.
Literally no additional methane from cattle being produced. They are part of the natural cycle, and it stays in the environment. It stays in the atmosphere for 10 to 12 years, breaks down, comes back down. Plants use it to grow. Cow eats it. It goes back up. It is the stupidest gimmick. And I told you not to let me get started on this.
Dude, this is why I'll say this, right? Because I watch a lot of your YouTube shorts, right? And I love your whole persona and your attitude, because there's like a cynicism in some of your videos, because you're like, do you guys see this is how dumb you sound when you say these things? And it's honestly one of the biggest reasons why I watch, and I think it's really interesting what you do and the way you present your information. So dude, yeah, get turned on, get turned up. You know what I mean? Turned
All
on.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's why we got you on here.
Let's,
you know?
Let's keep going then. So let's touch on veganism since we're going.
Less.
Biggest hypocritical group of people in the world are the vegans because they attack people like me and my dairy cattle who are eating the byproducts of their food, which allows their food to be cheaper and better for the environment, because my cows are using the byproduct, producing high quality proteins in the forms of meat and dairy, and then recycling it and making fertilizer that can go on crops
to make their vegan stuff.
To make the Yeah, you know, their favorite nut beverage.
Right. Which are worse for you.
Whichever, whether it's almonds or soy. Whatever. Cows eat the almond holes. Soy, you know what the byproduct of soy is? Soy meal. Cows eat the soy meal. It's never ending. These people, they attack my industry when we literally take and make the whole agricultural system more sustainable with ruminant digestive systems.
It really seems like a lot of vegans and mostly like activists in that arena think all of this exists in a vacuum. You know, that you don't need all of these things like dairy farmers or other agricultural farming that goes on, that, you know, everything can come from a box or a bag is kind of the way
store.
It seems.
It comes from store, the store. Right.
That's it, man. That's, you know, all of that meat in the store, it was, you know, that's just where it was grown.
Like,
you know, that's
step outside.
No.
Like the next step.
No. No, they don't, because even with their fake meats that they're growing in vats, mm-hmm. They realize that there is pollution coming out of those vats.
Right.
I don't think they do. I think they just think it just grows in there. Whether you're making meat in a vat or growing it with a cow, mm-hmm. there is a product that has to be dealt with that is not the meat. And it's a lot easier to deal with the product a cow makes, which is cow manure, which is the ideal fertilizer for any crop, than it is for the sewage coming off of those vats.
Mm-hmm. How much, like just in general, as we're talking about vegans, how much has people's preference for almond milk, coconut milk, all of that, how much has that impacted? Not a lot. Hasn't really impacted the dairy industry.
Not a lot. They love to brag about it. It's it's barely a drop in the bucket, and it's actually going down. They like to say that they're going to stop dairy products, but the main shift that's changed in the dairy industry is people aren't drinking their milk anymore. They're eating it. They've switched from fluid milk to cheeses and butter. Butter's good for you again. You know, some of us never thought
use
it was
it
bad for us. Yeah. It's a phenomenal product. Mm-hmm. I love butter.
Yeah.
It's amazing how animal fats and animal products all of a sudden aren't bad for you again.
It's almost like we evolved alongside animals all the way throughout history, you know?
That's a weird concept. You're not supposed to look at historical values, okay?
Right, okay. Everything, history started in 2010, I think.
Yes.
That's what, yes,
think,
you're right.
That so makes
I'll,
a lot more sense.
I'll correct myself, Derek. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Brandon.
We'll just edit that out. Just edit that out.
I got you. what were you going to say, Zach?
I was going to say, we're kind of touching on how like vegans or like people who are like real environmentally conscious don't think like several steps down. It reminded me. So when I was in high school, there was a big thing going on. It was talking about how the H1 Hummer is more environmentally friendly than the Toyota Prius. And it actually was documented and broken down by an Oregon state-based research in 2007. So your state, Derek, it was a 450-page report, and it was talking about how dust to dust, so the beginning of like of the full creation of an H1 Hummer to the end of its life, and the creation of a Toyota Prius to the end of its life, a H1 Hummer's average like environmental cost was 3.25 per mile. And the Prius was 3.25 per mile, and the Hummer was 1.95. So the Hummer was almost 50% more efficient for the environment. And the reason why they broke it down this way is they calculated that Hummers, if properly maintained with minimum like maintenance stuff, could easily go 35 years or 370,000 miles. A Prius with its electric batteries and stuff like that would have an average of about 12 years before things need to be replaced. And then they were saying that you can very easily recycle almost everything on a Hummer when it does finally die. But the batteries of a Prius and electric vehicles, they're very hard to recycle and usually just get thrown in a landfill. So it's like this whole idea of, oh, I'm driving in an energy efficient vehicle or whatever. It's like, okay, well, I'm pretty sure my Ford Raptor with its like 12.5 mpg is better for the environment than your Tesla, which is destroying the energy grid. And in like 10, 15 years, everything on it's got to go in a landfill. So it's just interesting.
That's no different than the wind turbines and the solar panels. Did you guys see what just happened in Texas with all those solar panels?
Oh, yeah.
Wiped out hailstorm that just destroyed a huge section.
The wind turbine thing is hilarious because those wind turbines are massive. There's graveyards
for them.
Yeah, they're massive. And people don't realize that they are just a giant spinning gears. So they need lubrication. The amount of oil that goes into those giant, crude oil that goes into those wind turbines is like the amount of energy they make doesn't equate the amount of oil used. So it would actually just be cheaper and more environmentally friendly to just burn coal.
Burn the oil.
Yeah,
or burn the oil. But not to mention the massive footings that you have for those things. That's a lot of concrete in the ground.
Yeah.
It's just insane amount of concrete.
They require oil changes like quarterly. So like their cost, it's like, I can't remember the exact number, and I'll see if I can find it again, but it's like I'm pretty sure it's like hundreds of thousands of like tens of millions of gallons of like oil just to maintain the wind turbines. I'll find it.
But don't worry, we're tearing out our hydroelectric dams in the Pacific Northwest.
I saw this.
Yeah, that's something I've been talking about. On the Snake River, they want to tear out a whole bunch of hydroelectric dams for the fish. Well, these dams already have fish ladders. They have no documentation that show that taking them out will actually help improve fish numbers. And what it's going to do, one, all that hydroelectric is gone, but all that irrigation water that they use up in Washington off of the Snake River and on the Snake River, most of that's gone. And then the barge system that all that agriculture, all the minerals, everything on the Snake River uses barges to ship it down river to the Columbia and out to sea. That all of a sudden either has to go on train or on trucks. And it's just going to be an environmental disaster.
This is one of those things where the government's cutting its nose off to spite its face, essentially, again.
Yeah, exactly.
I lived in Germany for several years, and the Germans have a ton of wind farms. And I have several friends who are Germans. They live there, and consistently you drive by wind farms every day, and they always, every time you couldn't drive by one without them bitching about just how stupid they are, and how much they don't produce the energy that they were told they were going to produce. So, I'll just laugh listening to you guys talk about it because they are just wildly inefficient. And I saw too that they, talking about the graveyards for the turbines is, there's a company out there who's turning the plastic or whatever it's made out of, I don't know if, into gummy candies. And Zach, you could Google it if you want, but they're turning the wind turbine rotors into gummy candies. Look it up, pull it up.
I will. So wind turbines, they take 1400 gallons of oil, 1,400 gallons of oil.
Turbine?
Like the wind turbines, yeah, per turbine.
Just one. Okay.
Yeah, just one. And they need to be changed out every 3 to 6 months, depending on usage. And I guess
depending on how much
wind, I guess, is making them spin. And I guess one big issue is that they leak a lot. In Sweden, their wind turbines make in energy like costs. Their wind turbines make anywhere from $2 to $6 million of energy per week. However, if you calculated the upkeep costs and the oil needed, it costs Sweden $7 million per week to maintain them. So Sweden is losing
math at its finest.
Yeah,
Sweden. I like that.
Sweden is losing $5 to $1 million per week in their wind turbines.
Jesus, that's insane, man.
It just makes your head hurt.
Yeah. No, dude.
It's like a massive play. We're all going to pretend that this is working and it's efficient until it absolutely can't be sustained anymore. And then we'll just go back to regularly programmed life using our brain, I guess. Whenever Greta Thunberg goes back to school, we'll all be better off. How dare you? You've stolen my childhood.
I guess that's the reason why they don't put wind turbines. I guess people are like, well, wind turbines, if you put them on coastal lines, they'll get like a lot of like energy. But the EPA is too afraid that the oil leaks will cause too much damage to the coastal regions. So they're not allowed to be there.
Weird.
Imagine that.
But it's clean energy.
Yeah, it's so clean.
They turn white into jelly candies.
The rotors or whatever, propellers.
Yeah.
There's a company that is converting them into gummy candies. I guess there's quote unquote safety. You won't find a bag of them in my house, I'll tell you that much. Yeah. But supposedly safe to eat. But I watched a documentary recently about some farms in Michigan that had to deal with some PFAS poisoning. Yep, you guys have any issues like that? Gummy bears, yeah. Look.
No, we don't have anything like that going on in Tillamook.
Okay.
But on a side note, you want to talk about sustainability.
Let's do it.
They are now making jet fuel out of the byproduct from cheese.
What?
They take the whey and they turn it into jet fuel.
Could you imagine if we used cheese to get to the moon? How ironic would that be? You know what I mean? Everybody used to think.
That's some aged cheese up there.
The moon. Yeah,
that's the moon. That's the real cheese reserve.
If we could really figure out how to make cheese into like full fuel, like you said, they're starting to do that, then we could just use the moon's cheese body to transport us to other celestial bodies.
There we go.
It's an infinite fuel hack.
That's like the one thing Star Trek was missing was dairy farmers, apparently.
Yeah.
You guys are going to boldly go.
No cow is gone.
No one wants to go.
The cow jumps over the moon. Yeah. Because he's launching with jet fuel at his butt.
It's all a conspiracy, dude. We've solved it. Have you ever experienced any sort of like sabotage from some of these people on your farm or know anybody in at least your community?
No, I mean, we've had some weird instances and people showing up that shouldn't be here, but I mean,
protesting.
No, nothing like that. They'd actually have to get out of their parents' basement and learn how to drive.
Hell yeah.
To be able to do something like that.
You're right.
Most of the people that are so active online and so offended about everything, they can't afford to drive anywhere or go anywhere.
It's like there's no bus stop out in front of my farm.
Myself, but yeah.
Right. Maybe I won't clip this and put it on social media.
No, you definitely can.
Well, I was gonna say, it's like Derek Josie calls out basement vegans.
I've told him that online already.
I know you have. Yeah.
Yeah. Because if they show up,
the basement vegans are not gonna see it. They're stuck in their echo chamber of like lunacy that they're never gonna see.
They regularly share my stuff on their lunatic channels. But I've built up such a following that they try and stay away. Most of them just stay away from me now. It's kind of sad. It really limits my ability to poke fun at them. Mm.
Well, then I'll share that and just be like, Eric Josie dares, right? That's what I'll do, too. I'll misspell your name on purpose and just use D-A-R-E. Dare it.
There we go.
Josie. Yeah. I'll get really creative with a crazy photo
of him being like... You know, just now, real big.
Now, I do have to say that not all vegans are like this. Okay. Mm. I always have somebody in the comments that go, I'm a vegan and I love your content. Not all vegans are bad. Some just, you know, they don't want to eat animal products for their own personal reasons. And I respect that.
Yeah.
To each their own.
Right.
I just don't respect when they, yes.
So yeah, not all vegans are bad.
But I like what you're saying.
I have seen some videos where cows will eat another, you know, they'll be like a bird and they'll just grab it with their tongue or something.
You're probably just interested.
I agree, man. You know, eat what you want to eat. Just don't tell me what to eat or how to live my life, dude. That's the whole point, right?
Mm-hmm.
The whole point. There's a section in your book here. This part blew my mind. I actually read it out loud to my wife. This is what I was talking about earlier. That is fucking crazy to me. I'm just going to read it, right? So state lawmakers are being influenced by animal rights activists to make livestock farming downright impossible, to not only work for a living, but to share that knowledge with our children. So one of the things in here is they're talking about a ballot initiative in Colorado called Initiative 16. It says it sought to revise a section of the state criminal code 18-9-201 that defines cruelty to animals. This is the initiative's expansion of the definition of a sexual act with an animal would criminalize additional conduct. And then you go on to say essentially that it was struck down in Colorado, but not so much in Oregon. And I'll let you speak on it. But the one thing, the point you made here is it's talking about artificial insemination. Mm-hmm. It says, let us think this through, add the overlay of how we pass this knowledge on down to our kids. So we accept that artificial insemination is a depraved sexual act, then we are presented with an even broader ramification that if we expose our children to artificial insemination and teach them the protocols and procedures, we are thereby exposing them to lewd sexual acts. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Can you so elaborate? Yeah.
In Oregon, I just pulled it up. There is, where is it? Ballot initiative petition 2026-028. Mm-hmm. That's it's written by the same people, and it's the third time they've tried this. They're out gathering signatures in Oregon. They have failed the first two times. Exact same thing. They will criminalize artificial insemination. In the bill, we're not even, or the petition, we aren't even sure if a veterinarian would be allowed to assist with a calving, because you would be doing things to an animal's vagina, uterus.
Yeah.
So all that, but I mean, it goes, it wouldn't allow you to slaughter animals in Oregon. It wouldn't allow you wouldn't be able to hunt in Oregon. And I know most people don't know this about, but Oregon, but, there's a lot of normal people in Oregon and a lot of hunting and fishing and wildlife.
My family's outside of the Portland. My family's all lives in LaGrande, Oregon in the
exactly. Blue
Mountains, so
yeah. On the east side. Yeah, so thankfully, even in Oregon, people are smart enough to read that and think, no, this is not something I'm willing to sign. So they've failed, but they have so much money that they'll just keep trying, and they just have to get it somewhere.
Yeah,
and then once they get it in on the books somewhere, then they can try and push it out from there. Mm-hmm. It's no different than what they did in California with, I can't remember what the initiative was, but it regulated through the ballot box how farmers were able to house pigs and chickens, and made it so there was minimum requirements on size. Mm-hmm. And then since California made that regulation, it spread throughout the United States, because anybody that wanted to sell product into California had to follow their rules. Mm-hmm. So, and that's how they continue to push the extreme animal rights agenda, is by ballot initiatives and pushing laws that just don't make sense to anybody with common sense.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Dude, I read that, and that's insane. I just couldn't imagine. You know, well, let me ask you this. What would happen to dairy farming if you guys could not artificially inseminate cows?
So we'd have to go back to having bulls running with our herd, which means you would have more cattle being injured in the breeding process, because when a bull is breeding a cow, it's not nearly as easy and simple as when we artificially inseminate a cow. Injuries of farmers would go up, because bulls are aggressive, especially intact bulls. I would not have the ability to walk out into my herd with my kids who are younger and be, you know, at ease, because you'd always be thinking about, okay, where's the bull? It would.
And now
it
you
would
need a lot
severely,
more bulls, right? Or you just need one.
Yeah, a lot more bulls, and it would severely limit the genetics, because right now, we have bull studs, and we can buy genetics because we have a registered Jersey herd. I can buy a bull, semen from a bull that was raised on a farm in New York.
Right.
Without ever having to ship the bull. This bull can be used throughout the world. It gives you the ability to have the best genetics at your fingertips. And so if you want to try a bull, it's like $10 or $20 for a unit of semen versus spending $3,500 to buy a bull and then ship them to your farm.
It's interesting.
It really allows you.
It's interesting. These type of people are so against like artificial insemination, yet they're probably the same type of people that are perfectly fine with changing their own gender and mutilating themselves.
Yeah, there you go.
So on that note, I had
trust the science, a video but of, I don't like you doing science on your cows
or kids. Yeah. Wood chipper. Anyway,
facts. Wood chipper.
I was showing a video of the cows being milked, and somebody, and I know they were serious. They were like, "How come none of your all your cows have girl names?"
Because wow. They're girls.
Two genders, and cows with udders are females. Yeah.
So I did a whole video talking about why that was the case, and I was very careful because I did not get flagged on any social media for hateful content because I specifically were talking about the biological facts with cattle and how there is only you know, because I am
you don't have nine binary cows.
No.
Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, we do have steers, which, I mean, they're not intact males, so they are, they're still male.
Unit cows. Yeah.
Yeah. They're units.
Genetically.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's just, no. So that's a thing I hadn't even thought about when you mentioned, like, just the genetic pool, right? Like, you would have to, I feel like, constantly be rotating bulls. It would almost be a process you'd have to, you know, organize with farmers sort of in your local area so that you weren't traveling to freaking Nebraska to get a bull, you know, because it's not economically feasible.
If you had a genetic issue, it'd be harder for you to track down what bull it came from, and it could like ruin generations of your cows. Like it could.
There's literally breed specific genetic mutations that we track, and we do genomically test all our cows, and so we get cows that are flagged with certain things so that we know, oh, you don't want to use this bull because he has the same potential for this genetic mutation. Keep away from that bull. It would just set us back a lot.
Is mad cow disease a genetic disease?
No, mad cow disease happens when you feed cows cow parts is how they were grinding up cows. I'm probably getting this a little bit wrong, including their brains, and so that's how you get mad cow disease.
Okay.
Should not do that with cattle.
Yeah, sure, they're vegan.
Going back to
you probably
them being
shouldn't
vegan,
do that
right?
as humans either. Don't eat humans if you're human.
Yeah,
common
Haiti.
Sense.
It's very zombie. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. No.
Especially the brain matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's all kinds of, I don't remember what it's called, but there is a disease that humans can get from eating human brain and, or just brain in general. I don't know. I have family in the South, and, pig brain specifically is a thing down there. So, but you won't catch me eating pig brain. So,
no, I mean,
pigs
bacon,
are very
bacon for sure.
Brain, probably not.
I'm good.
Pig anatomy is very similar to human anatomy. Like the way they're like formed. That's why a lot of doctors and stuff, they'll practice on pigs because it's very similar to how the human body reacts.
Yeah, their digestive system is a lot like ours too. So we've ragged on the government a lot, but they just came out with a ruling that I think most agriculturists in the United States are happy with. It's
pro-government take.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's pro-government. It's more of a like, well,
a
no
positive
crap.
Government thing.
Yeah. Product of the United States.
Okay.
It's a voluntary label because last time it was, you know, mandatory. And World Trade Organization came after us. But they think if voluntarily you can get away with it. But if it's animal-based, the animal has to be born, raised, slaughtered, packaged, and sold in the United States to be a product of the United States. Now,
okay.
Before, you could bring cattle from, you know, Mexico or down from Canada, slaughter them in the United States and call that a product.
So it's more honest.
It's more honest. Yeah.
Got you.
So that's one good thing they've done.
Okay. Well, that is good because, I mean, there's so much misrepresentation in advertising already anyway.
God, yes.
Yeah. Since we're on this track, what's another positive thing the government does for dairy farming?
Well, I would say that the insurance program that...
Okay.
Well, I can't even say that they came up with it. It was industry because the industry was like, okay, we don't really like how you're doing this where you just come in heavy-handed and just buy a bunch of product and artificially screw with the market. How about we have a softer approach where there's fail-safes if we need them, but otherwise they aren't being used.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. Why is it important to teach kids about farming?
That's a very good question. It's important for people in general, not just kids, but if you teach kids about it, they have that base knowledge once they are adults. And so if there is something they see online and it's complete bullshit, that little bullshit meter in their head actually goes off and they go, no, I know that that's not true because I've been on a farm or I've talked with a dairy farmer. Or I've gone and seen how corn's actually grown, you know?
So, go ahead. Finish your thought.
Well, so then you have that insulation from the next generation continuing to push these stupid regulations and laws because you've built a buffer of well-educated citizens, which everybody should be. We need more well-educated citizens and less morons that vote on emotion.
Sure. Yeah. Couldn't agree more there.
That was fire right there.
It was. I like it. Derek came with fire. Do you ever host kids or groups on your farm and just kind of show them your process and teach people?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually hosting next Wednesday. It's a group of soon to graduate veterinarians from Oregon State. Nice. We're going to be discussing some biosecurity measures and things like that we do on our farm. And it's going to be actually a great chance for me to pick the brain of, you know, 15 or 20 upcoming veterinarians that have just gone through school to see if they have any ideas on what we should be doing.
Okay. What specifically are you hoping to learn from them?
Just see what they're really just to see what they're being taught in school and see if there's any new technologies that they know about. And I want them to have actual on-farm experience on how
absolutely
some of these ideas might actually work on a farm. Because a lot of the times, like when I was in college, I'd have professors that would tell me, well, this doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, well, we've been doing it since I was a kid that way, and it absolutely does work. So what are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so getting that out of the classroom experience will be good for them too. And we do also, I mean, I have a viewing area that I'm setting up so that I can have school tours come. Awesome. Hopefully Oregon, there's a group called Adopt a Farmer where you go into a classroom, you teach them in the classroom, and then the whole class comes out to the farm. I was supposed to get involved in that in 2020, and then, you know, the world fell apart. So it's probably about time to reconnect and get that going again.
Got you. So you have a degree in dairy science?
No, I am a college dropout. Absolutely. Ah, okay.
Hell yeah.
I was out there for 3 years. I took a lot of classes. I learned a lot, but I also learned a lot of things outside the classroom there. And
for sure.
Came to the point where my old man needed me home. And so I was like, okay.
Well, I went to college first in Wisconsin, which, as you know, is a big dairy area, right? Just a little bit, you know. And I got to admit, when I met a couple guys that I was partying with, and they're like, "Oh yeah, our degree's in dairy science." My first thought was, what the fuck is dairy science, you know? And then they actually explained it to me, and they both were farmers' kids. And I was like, dude, there's so much that goes into this. Just like you talking about the artificial insemination process and gene pools for bulls and breeding. It's just like, yeah, this really is a science. There's a lot involved here.
Absolutely. I mean, we're making rocket fuel out of
cheese
byproducts. So, yeah. You know,
up our cheese reserve, you know, go to the moon.
And I mean, your modern dairy farm is nothing like it was, you know, even 20 years ago. All my cows have basically Fitbits. They're on collars that keep track of their rumination. It keeps track of where they're at in the barns, how long they're at the bunk eating, how long they're laying. It keeps track of their, that tells me when they're in heat and ready to get bred. It flags them if they're not eating as much as they normally do, so that I know when my cow is not feeling well, so I can get her, you know, whether it's some Tums or something to make her feel better. And it's allowing me to be a better dairyman. My milking parlor keeps track of how many pounds of milk every cow is giving every milking, and flags cows if they drop in milk, or if there's a variation, if it takes longer for them to milk out, because that's a sign that there might be a problem. The data that I have flowing, I mean, I'm sitting at a desk that has four different monitors on it right now. It's
a lot,
insane.
Are there cow Wi-Fi size
in my barns?
Are there cow size Tums? Are they actually like giant Tums for cows?
They're really good. They're good size. Yeah.
Wow.
It's ironic that Tums are basically just like calcium, and you're, you know, where do you get your calcium from? Milk. And you're giving the circle of life, man, you know?
Cause like my cows have a nutritionist. They eat better than I do, which isn't hard to do. I do love my Danishes.
Danishes.
I saw that sometimes like Skittles, they give Skittles to cows. That's real.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a sugar. So if it's part of a balanced nutritional diet, they'll use it as part of the ingredient list. Because I have what's called a TMR. It's a total mixer ration. I have a semi with a box that I can fit like 25,000 pounds worth of feed in there. So I'm loading all the different ingredients into it, and it's mixing it like a blender. So my cows every day are getting their balanced ration designed by a nutritionist. We test all the byproducts to see what's in them. We test their forages to make sure they're getting the right protein, their right macros, their everything.
Yeah,
it's down incredible. To a science.
That's another thing that I wanted to, I guess, touch on is, or I guess, like say about the dairy industry is that the Skittles that are like in your TMR isn't like normal, like store-bought Skittles. It's like the weird Skittles that they can't put in a bag. It's like the messed up Skittles, which to that industry would just get thrown away because they can't sell it. But now they can sell it to the dairy industry. And I guess like other candy, like Hershey's does it. Like there's like a lot of stuff that because they know you need sugar or you need other stuff for your cows that they will, they're weird.
There's bakery.
When the rhesus doesn't come out the right way, it's smashed and gets put in your TMR or something.
I have a buddy that has donuts and things like that go into his TMR because it's waste product. It was messed up, and so it's something you can buy on the market.
Yeah. Dude, that's awesome. I had no idea.
That goes back to cows make the whole system more sustainable. It's
right.
The hatred that the cow gets. They're eating the
Skittles you don't want to.
Yeah. The hatred that the cows get. So when you're drinking milk, you're still tasting the rainbow, okay?
Oh. I like that. Taste the milky rainbow.
There we go.
Yeah. That should be Skittles' new campaign slogan. I'm down for that. Do you hope that your kids take over what you're doing?
I do, because I mean, I did just do a major expansion, and one of the reasons I did it was so that in the future, 20 years from now, if one of them wants to take over, they're able to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think anybody that is the fourth generation on farm hopes that the next generation wants it.
Yeah.
I have done the things that I think will make it a viable option, where a lot of multi-generational farms fall to the wayside is they just kind of do the same thing, and they don't expand, or they don't change to make it so that the next generation might want to take over.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if my dad hadn't expanded from 60 acres and 60 cows when he came home to the 300 when I came home, it wouldn't have been a viable option for me. So if you want your next generation to be able to take over your business, you have to make it a business worth taking over.
That makes sense.
And then and it's a win-win, because if none of them, you know, if they all are successful in doing their own thing, it allows me not to have to pressure them to come home, because I have a viable business that somebody else can come in and buy.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, none of you want this? Sweet. I'm retiring. I'm out of here.
Right.
So, man, it's a win-win.
Definitely. What would you say is the most misunderstood thing about the dairy industry that Americans should know? And that's a loaded question, probably. But
that is a loaded question, but I would say it's about all of animal agriculture. The most common misconception would be that animals aren't treated well, because the animals pay the bills, and mistreated animals, whether it's a beef cow that's going to market or a dairy cow that's producing milk, if they're not fed correctly, if they're not taken care of, you're going to have a less desirable product. Mm-hmm. You're going to lose money. And as much as they like to say, oh, you're only in it for the profit, you're damn right I am. I like to make money mm-hmm. to pay my bills.
As you said in your book, who works not for money?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Not even nonprofits. Those
right
people make a lot of money. They anyway, sure do. Yeah. Total different subject. So most common misconception would be that animals in agriculture are abused or mistreated uh-huh. when everything we do is designed for cow comfort, for animal comfort, to create the best product on the market.
Yeah. Dude, awesome. I really appreciate you taking the time to come out and talk to us. And this is something that I don't think a lot of people know about. And it's one of the reasons why, since we started this podcast, I wanted to talk to farmers and not just, you know, dairy farmers, people that have, you know, regular agricultural farms. I don't know if you guys even, if you grow your own corn for feed or whatever. And this, go ahead.
We do. Actually, I've decided this year I'm just going to grow grass, not the kind you smoke.
It is Oregon.
Because in our climate, we're more suited to grow grass. So mm-hmm. I'll actually have a better product to feed my cows by growing mm-hmm. the grass and purchasing corn from somewhere else. And gotcha. That goes back to one size doesn't fit all in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to fit something into my environment that doesn't make sense, it's better off letting local farmers make their own decisions.
It just makes sense. That's the whole point of small government. One of the points of small government is you're supposed to be able to make decisions about things where you're at, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's a shame to see a lot of that disappearing in our country. We could have a lot longer conversation about a lot of that. That's for sure. And Zach and I do on this podcast. And if you ever want to come back and talk about that stuff, you are always more than welcome to as well. But no, I just wanted to say, you know, having had a dairy farmer in my family, you know, it's a lot of work, and I know it is. And I really appreciate all of you guys, you know, the fact that you've done this for generations, that your family, you know, helps. I see you guys out there on your videos. It's a family thing. You guys are out there doing mm-hmm. it together. Yeah, I think that's amazing.
I just posted a video 2 days ago where my 5-year-old daughter, we were in the tractor, and she was like, I want to drive.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay. I put her on there. I actually jumped out. I mean, the tractor was going 1 mile an hour.
Yeah.
So it's not like it was a high risk situation.
Sure. But
that will give her the confidence going forward to be willing to try more mm-hmm. and do more. And not it was kids low get risk. That. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason kids that grow up in agriculture usually are successful wherever they go, because mm-hmm. they understand the value of work and mm-hmm. most of the time you're actually having to think on your feet and
better problem solving
come up
skills.
With solutions to problems. Yeah.
Dude, we, Zach and I say this all the time, so I'm going to hop on the soapbox real fast and say, you know, that's, I think, one of the biggest reasons why kids today have a lot of the mental health issues they have is because they grew up too easy. And the human mind needs adversity to develop. And if we didn't have all of this around us, this first world crap that we have, you know, we would be living and having to compete with our environment to stay alive. And that's why human beings have evolved and become the way we are, you know. And so when you have a child who has no adversity growing up, then I just think that's the most unnatural thing and way for them to grow up. And that's why they probably have all of this anxiety. There's something wrong, right? So,
yeah, because
you know,
they've never had to come up with a solution to a problem. So exactly. As soon as they're out in the world on their own, the real world, even in the first world, is a dog-eat-dog world. So
definitely.
You better know how to figure shit out.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise.
Yeah. And not to soapbox too hard, but I mean, that's why a lot of the airmen and in our military and the Air Force, I see the 18 to 20 year old crowd, they can't handle even, you know, being disagreed with, you know. Let me not think that being disagreed with means that I'm being attacked, but they everything is an attack, you know. So again, we could soapbox about that, and we do pretty hard on this podcast. So, but yeah, no, it's a good thing that you make it a family affair. You're teaching your kids invaluable lessons.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And everybody's offended about everything because they've never had anything real to be offended about. So
yeah, we got to make up shit to get mad about. That's for sure. Yeah. So where can people find you, Derek?
So I have my social media channels are TDF Honest Farming. I also have a website, tdfhonestfarming.com.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at Derek Josie on Twitter, where you will see me be a real jerk sometimes. And then I do an Industry Worth Fighting For is available on Amazon.
It is. It's actually a really, really good read. And I'm glad. I hope more people pick it up. We have a very small podcast. You know, but if you're seeing this, it's worth it.
I slammed a lot of information to a very short read, and it's not boring. It's entertaining.
It's not. And I thought it was funny that you mentioned at the end here that when you Google yourself, one of the first things that comes up, I thought that was kind of funny. It's like, why do people give a shit? You know, I'll leave it. I won't spoil it. Chapter 14, answering the burning questions. But
yeah,
it's just funny. You did a very good job, man.
Yeah. It is funny. I don't understand. I mean, a week or two ago, no, it was probably a month or two ago now, mm-hmm. time flies, there was articles going out that I had perished.
What?
I died. Yeah. AI generated articles about my death. And I was just like, oh, shoot.
That had to be kind of creepy.
It was. And I know what it was about because I had talked about my brother-in-law who had just died.
Oh, okay.
And so it just turned into I died. I was just like, oh.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen anytime soon.
Well, you know, if it does, I've got a lot of life insurance, so my family will be okay.
There you go.
That's what a responsible adult does.
That's right. Absolutely. Cool, man. Well, thank you very much for coming on. Please, like I said before, guys, find it on Amazon, An Industry Worth Fighting For. I really enjoyed reading it, and I think everybody else will too. So, and check out Josie's social media website. Always really good videos. Your clapbacks are pretty good, I'm not going to lie. You post
That's one of my favorite things to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll just say this real fast before we wrap up, is there is just so much ignorance about the dairy farming industry that, like, how can you come at the one of the few actual experts? You don't know what the fuck you're talking about. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So shut the fuck up.
But they'll go into all caps mode. Actually.
Yeah. Listen here. My professor said this about you. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, your professor's talking about me, so he must know me.
Exactly. That's right, bitch. All press is good press. But
yes, it is.
All right, man. On that note, we'll wrap it up. Again, thank you, Josie, or Derek, for coming on talking to us. And I learned some things. I hope everybody listening learned a few things too.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. Absolutely.